Good evening. This is Nanette Renone. The program is Feminist Conversations. This week, before I introduce my guest for the evening, I'd like to talk for a minute about the problems or the ideas that we've been addressing on this program over the last couple of months. Basically, we've been trying to work on a theory of women's role in society. On recent programs, we've been trying to work out the relationship between women's historical experience and Marxism. Now, speaking very generally, Marxist history concerns itself mostly with the area of work, with the area of production, and it focuses on how human consciousness, human behavior, and human relations are affected by changes in the ownership and the organization of the means of production. This emphasis on work, on the work sphere, of course, to a large extent excludes women, because many women do not work in the public world, in the work world, and even when they do, they are almost always also engaged in the private sphere, in the family. So they have two jobs. Now, the task of bringing together or developing a women's history that works in some conjunction with Marxism seems to be to discover the links between changes in production, changes in the work that people do, and changes in the family, how those two things relate to each other. And with my guest tonight, I'm going to be talking about that. Her name is Renata Breidenthal. She is a historian and teaches at Brooklyn College, and she is also at Brooklyn College a coordinator of the Women's Studies program there. Now, to begin, Renata, I gave there a very brief outline of what the program has been doing and what I think is the task of feminism and Marxism together. And I wanted to ask you to fix it and make it better than I did. Okay.
Well, any summary, you know, tends to leave out some things, and I'd like to, I think I'd say refine rather than correct what you said, which is to say that I don't think that Marxist historiography leaves women out in that sense. It hasn't really focused specifically on women because it's been most interested in the development of the means of production and social relations in general, and the most important results of that have been the development of classes, and of course men and women tend to fall into certain classes, and there are, I would agree with the analysis that men and women of a particular class have shared some very important experience that argues that one should look at them together. The idea that Marx and even more Engels developed in Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State was that social relations, including family relations, also can be related back to the mode of production, that they evolve in a certain way because people produce commodities in a certain way. And one of the things that Engels, working, among other things, with notes that Marx had made, was one of the observations he made was that women are among the first group to be subordinated when property becomes more privatized.
Less communalized,
mm-hmm. Right. Tends to be more in the area of private property. So I would just like to say that it's not, I think, that Marx has left women out. It's that he has seen their work also and has focused on their work as it comes into the sector of the production of commodities, which then becomes paid labor. But there are also effects on family life in general and women's work inside the family, which can be analyzed in Marxist terms, which is sort of the basic structure that I tend to see it in also. So I see it more as a refinement of a basic theory, which I think suits a lot of the evidence I've been able to look at.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way that we can talk about the means of production and the things that we've been talking about in a way that almost anyone out there would connect with what we're saying? We're talking about a historical development going from a pre-capitalist agricultural society. This is what we're going to do into industrial society and then into the stage now of advanced capitalism. And we're going to spend some time there, which is where everybody is right now. But I was just thinking if maybe we could, for the moment, give some language that people are more familiar with.
Well, let's just look at it historically for a minute to see what the general trends have been. Marx was most concerned to see the development of capital and the mode of production through capitalist industrialization and accumulation of capital. And one of the things that we see here as far as women's history is concerned is that it immediately takes certain activities that were previously done privately out of the home and makes them public. As a matter of fact, the Industrial Revolution, the big Industrial Revolution, took off on textiles, which was originally women's work, and became factory-produced. So that's one area right away which was taken out of what might be considered, you know, pre-capitalist relations and brought into the into a public wage-earning sector. A lot of women in early parts of the Industrial Revolution, whole families were taken, actually, into this kind of production, and women also, and became factory employed in the factories. Let me see how to put this. This is a really whole complicated development that goes into this, because this does not immediately break up the family, which is why I slipped that in, that whole families sometimes went into the factory, including children, and were, in effect, their own parents were their supervisors. So what I'm saying is I'm modifying a general statement. The general statement has been that industrialization has tended to break up the family by taking production of certain items which were made at home into the public sphere and, you know, breaking it up. That was a much slower process. But the overall tendency is still true. A lot of commodities that began to be produced more publicly then came away from the family, or family production, or more private production. And it brought some women into the wage-earning situation, but a lot of women it did not bring into the wage-earning situation. So that meant, for a very general overall picture, that for those women who, let's say, went to work in a factory, their lives now became divided into two spheres, which have sometimes been called the double burden. There's work and the family, and it became one of the things that muckrakers in the Industrial Revolution pointed to as a disaster, that it was very hard, that it was exploitative, that it was also obviously exploitative of children, that it disrupted family life. And that's one aspect, let's say, for the working women who actually went out. For the women who actually stayed home, as more and more things came to be made as commodities which were sold and made by wage earners who were paid for this, they were, in some senses, disemployed. Their whole role in the family changed from a producer to a consumer. And when I say product, that goes into the whole shift from an agrarian economy to an industrial economy. We find that agriculture also, after industrialization, agriculture also becomes mechanized, industrialized. It becomes big business. There are very few really significant private farms anymore. And when it becomes that, women stop working in agriculture also. They stop producing things which previously they might have sold on the market for a small private gain, such as eggs, you know, or dairying the milk from the cows, the kind of thing that women tended to do when they were in agriculture or gardening, and thereby kind of lose their productive function. And also, for those women who do not go into the factory, and a much smaller proportion went into wage earning than actually stayed home, they lose their input into the family as to what they contribute, you know, in any productive way. What their role then tends to become is to transform the wage which the male laborer has earned as his work takes him increasingly out of his own private artisanal works or agricultural works. They transform that wage into usable things at home. They purchase and they they transform by cooking, or they transform by, let's say, sewing, although even that, you see, gets less and less, because mm-hmm. by the time you get into advanced capitalism, you can get prepackaged foods, you get ready-made clothes. You know, there is less and less that the housewife actually does, which is productive, and she comes to symbolize, in a sense, to the degree that she stays at home or is a home person, that the whole family has moved from being a productive unit to being a consuming unit. And she stands for the consumption aspect of it, which has given her whole role a very ambivalent coloring. You know, at its worst, it can be, you know, the caricature of the spendthrift comes from that, you know. At its best, you get into sort of the homemaking qualities of it, and there's another whole movement of around home economics, which began in the late 19th century and evolved to save the reputation of the home, I mean, to make it still have a high status. It was actually a very conservative movement, you know, because it was trying to preserve the home and give it a new coloring and give women a sense that they were also managers, you know, efficiency experts who could bring rationalization into their house, as if, you know, which was really ridiculous because they couldn't be both mm-hmm. the supervisor and the worker without adding to their work.
Okay, now...
I'm sorry, I was going ahead into another area.
You raised two very interesting areas of inquiry.
Yeah.
The first is why, if you take textiles, something that women had been doing in the home, mm-hmm. And doing practically every stage of it, they weren't even buying necessarily the cloth, but they were making the cloth and then making the clothing. Why, when machinery is developed so that it can be done on a larger scale, that is the production of textiles and the making of clothes on a larger scale, more efficiently, mm-hmm. with less labor, do women not have a significant role in the production, decision-making of those things? And the farm also. The farm would seem to be mm-hmm. even a more protected area, so that women were making butter, making eggs, and they were selling them, trading them, mm-hmm. or whatever. Then when machinery comes in there, they somehow don't have control of that machinery, they don't make decisions, and if they have farm jobs, it's way down on the totem pole.
Yeah, there are lots of layers in your questions mm-hmm. to answer. And first of all, I don't want to, if I gave the impression, I want to correct it now, that women did not operate the machinery. At the beginning stages of industrialization, they certainly did. And the reason for that at that time was that they were a cheap labor pool, you know. Mm-hmm. Just the presence of women in the labor force increases the number of people available. It increases the reserve pool of labor and depresses wages altogether, and that's an advantage to an industry, you know, to the capitalist who is expecting the profit, right? So they certainly were used. Whole families, as I said, were used in the beginning. It doesn't make too much sense to single out a single industry. You know, you sort of have to look at the picture in the total, in its total evolution. That's one point. The other point is, again, it really is a question of the total structure of a given society. Women have been used almost perennially, let's say within the capitalist industrialization thing, as a reserve pool of labor, so that it isn't even true for agriculture totally to say that women were not employed at different stages.
I wasn't meaning
they
to
are.
Suggest they yeah. weren't employed. I mean to suggest that they weren't in control. They weren't
okay.
making decisions about how...
Right, okay. Control is a very crucial word in this, because those who control in the end are those who really control the capital that moves the entire economic machinery, and very often ultimately also, in fact, usually the political machinery through several, you know, mechanisms. And to even talk about that in the Western European scene is hardly to talk of women at all, because by the time you talk about industrialization, you're talking about a society that's already well advanced in terms of property relations, even in terms of land. You're walking into a society that has had private property for many centuries. That men have effectively controlled, and the more the modern state develops to protect those private properties, the more you find women effectively not operating those levers. They tend to have been most powerful when, if you can use that word, that's always a relative term here, when political institutions were relatively decentralized, and even in such a case, it was upper-class women who were in families which controlled a large amount of property that could exercise, let's say, surrogate power, say when the noble was away on a crusade or in a battle, or perhaps through her family, where clan structures still remain, like larger kinship structures, through her own attachment to her former family, through control, say, over her dowry, could exercise some sort of property control if families had so arranged it. But altogether, property relations are very linked there still to Roman law, which was very important in Western civilization. And in European, I'm talking about Western European civilization, and the property relations are already so structured that it works like that. Furthermore, there's another really important ingredient in all of that. When you get a new class coming in, like a middle class, a rising bourgeoisie, with commercial capital or later with industrial capital, one of the ways that capital is consolidated inside of families is through inheritance and merger of different families. So it becomes very important for a class like that when it's aiming for power, much more than when it's actually in power, when it's aiming for power to establish legitimacy and the legitimacy of its heirs. So two things happen there. One thing is that to protect that legitimacy, women tend to be confined to the home, their chastity preserved, their sexuality regulated, you know, to ensure that those heirs are the legitimate heirs and will pass on the property intact. In other words, the women really serve a class function there to protect the class. And their cooperation is enlisted undoubtedly because there are real material interests to be gained. I mean, who would want to be a working wage earner, you know, if you can, you know, have the benefits of being in the wealthier middle class. The other point that's related to that, I've kind of lost the thread of it now. Well, it'll come back. That's really the major point at this junction.
Yeah. So I take it that what you're saying just
summarize. Yes, it comes back. Competition. Competition was the other point, because this is really very interesting as the Middle Ages goes out, toward the declining Middle Ages, and rising commercial capital comes in, you know, merchant families that develop property, and as the craft guilds get increasingly closed and protective, and also if there is other economic dislocation, like a depressive situation, like toward the end of, you know, in the 14th century depressive situation, you find women gradually being pushed out of guilds, and there's a very clear process of that in the 17th century, that women get pushed out of even guilds that they had previously been allowed into, and the ultimate result of that is to reduce competition. So since a middle class depends on competition to get ahead, keeping the woman, or the middle class woman anyway, in the home serves the two functions of legitimacy and reducing competition. And that gets passed on down later in the modern period. In the working class, it becomes another kind of a problem where you need the woman on the one hand to bring in an extra wage if one wage is not enough. At the same time, that same woman will be a competitor on the labor market, you know, like indirectly, you might almost say, with her own husband, though it's rarely so. I mean, there are different areas that women tend to work in. But now, for example, in a recession such as this, you can feel this very keenly. You know, we felt this in the Depression of 29, where male laborers were very concerned that women would depress wages or scab and could often be used like that. At the same time, those might be women whose own husbands were unemployed. So it becomes a very terrible situation on that level.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the difference between a pre-capitalist or agricultural society in which the roles for women when they have a significant role in making things, in production, mm-hmm. and when there's more of an integration between their home life and their work life, if they should have mm-hmm. a work life, mm-hmm. And then you look to the changes brought by industrialization, there can be a sense in which, looking back at that pre-industrial, you know, we idealize it.
It's a golden age.
Right. Now, I would imagine that all periods bring with them, for women, since they have such an ambivalent role in a way, both liberating mm-hmm. tendencies as well as those that take
yes.
control out of their yeah. hands. So looking at the process of industrialization, now so far it has sounded very grim for women. Mm-hmm. They got two jobs instead of one, or mm-hmm. if they were middle-class women, they were in a kind of nowhere's place of mm-hmm. not really having a job and just mm-hmm. sitting around or mm-hmm. you know, not really having any power in the home. Mm-hmm. And so how does that work? Where is the liberating aspect? I mean, of course, I suppose people's work was lessened.
Well, I don't know that it was less. Well, yes, I guess in some ways you could say it was reduced, in as much as technological innovation will take some of the sheer expenditure of muscle energy, will reduce that. That gets very hard here to compare, because the kind of changes, the losses and the gains, are apples and oranges kinds of comparisons. What mm-hmm. you might lose in terms of sheer output of muscular energy and gain a certain ease, you certainly do lose a lot of creativity. For example, there are lots of one of the aspects of modernization is the creation of unskilled jobs, simple, routine, repetitive. It facilitates production, you know, but it is a mind-deadening thing. Those happen to be the kinds of jobs that women tended to flow into, you know, partly because they could, you know, they were not trained for skill, since they would have to be at home, and they could move in and out of the labor market easily as the economy demanded it, or partly in conjunction with their own lives, you know, their own life cycles with respect to childbearing and rearing. So I don't know that the gains and losses can be measured only in terms of what's easier or what's harder. But what there is definitely a liberating aspect. I mean, Marx recognizes this, that becoming a wage earner for anybody, in a sense, frees one from the personal service relationship, say, that feudalism had. You have at least some set of options as to who you will work for. You have more geographical mobility, perhaps. You know, the options are somewhat illusory, because they're not as many as, you know, one is inclined to think there are. And the negotiation for wage, which is called free, in fact, is very narrowed by the actual economic situations of pressure on the wage, etc., in the marketplace and whatever economic conjuncture there is at that time. So the options are partly illusory and partly real, but there is a relatively liberating aspect to it. And for women, specifically, to earn a wage is to free her from the immediate domination of the patriarchal relationship of the family. It puts her, however, in another patriarchal relationship of the society at large. Now, when Marx looked at that, he anticipated that that would ultimately lead to a higher consciousness of what an oppressive relationship was, and some opportunity for women as workers to meet as other workers would, to, say, unionize and ultimately develop a revolutionary consciousness and overcome that, you know, that it was a stage toward a more independent being.
And so?
And so what?
What happened?
What happened?
It is true that out of this strain between women at work and women
right.
at home, and that what you called a double burden, you did get energy for a first women's movement. You did get...
Well, the first women, calling them one and two is a little bit arbitrary on my part, because people have looked at the first feminism of the 19th century further subdivided, and there are waves in there, ebbs and tides, but I put them all together as one, because this is essentially the bourgeois women's movement who struggled for equality within their class, you know. And what they were noticing was their oppression as women inside their class. They wanted equality of the middle class, in effect, the right to have the same rights as the men of their class, such as to vote, and a lot of the emphasis ultimately devolved on an enormous energy toward getting the vote. The second feminist consciousness of that we are living through is more radical, I think, because it really questions total patriarchal structures more seriously, and also looks at a psychological dimension that was not so ignored in the 19th century. When you look at the documents, you really see they really knew a lot of this, but such things as consciousness-raising groups, which probe very deeply into the subjective experience, were not, you know, felt to that degree. So I would say the second wave of feminism is probably more a result of the experience that women have, say, of what I would call the working class, although they might not so call themselves, say, white-collar groups or professionals who are paid a salary. They're not property owners. They don't control capital. They don't organize or control the economy. But they often call themselves middle class because they're not blue-collar workers or doing manual labor. But they, for example, a woman like that might go into the marketplace and draw a relatively low wage. You know, even now, women don't earn full men's salaries. It's anywhere, depending on what you're doing. Clerical work can be as little as 40% of a male wage, up to professionals who may get, 80%, 90%. And if you're, in some kind of an organized teachers union or something, it might be equal, except then they get slotted in lower positions. So it's still not really equal pay for equal work. But what they would feel when they go out like that is that they're in a lower position than men of their class. Like, they would really feel that disjuncture, that their family places them on one class level or within the class on one level, and their actual personal presence out there on another. So they can see their double life right in their own personality. And it would cause one to question, why is this happening? That's a particular kind of attention. But there are lots of other things that happen that, for example, one of the ways that women come into the marketplace now is not really that much in production of commodities, which are sold for a profit, but rather in the what is sometimes called the tertiary sector or the services industry, which I see as being very largely the same reproductive services that women had previously done in the home. For example, teaching, nursing, psychiatry, ministering to people's needs in businesses like the secretarial work, which is, half housekeeping. Mm-hmm. Clerical and sales work are all, subsidiary to actually production commodities. But where it's in the reproduction area like that, then women are really in a very funny role because they're doing now for a wage what they used to do inside the family. And that has all sorts of interesting developments because it really, a layer of institutionalization sort of intervenes now between them and the child. A layer of institutionalization came between them and products before, mm-hmm. and now it's coming between them and their child.
I want to take that a little bit more slowly, okay?
Sure.
We move from one stage to the other stage very quickly. Because between industrial capitalism or the introduction of heavy industrialization to the time we have now, there are real changes, it seems, mm-hmm. in the kinds of work that are available to people generally.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're talking about the whole service sector
mm-hmm.
Of work,
mm-hmm.
Which didn't exist. People were manufacturing things which were then sold. Mm-hmm. And now mm-hmm. there are enormous numbers of people who are employed in what we're calling service, whether it's teaching or mm-hmm. welfare work of some kind and others of that. And women seem to have high employment there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think the first thing, and then when you talk, we don't have so much then the public sphere of production of work
mm-hmm.
and a private sphere of the home
mm-hmm.
Being maintained, but we have the public production, and then we have a kind of socialization
mm-hmm.
of the tasks that were done by women. So now, not only are women
mm-hmm.
not producing and having control over production,
mm-hmm.
but they're also not having control in the private sector over the socialization of the children, rearing children,
mm-hmm.
taking care of those things that need to be done. Now, the question is why... I think I want to go back a little bit because you talk about the fact that the split in the industrial era between public production and private reproduction of private family lives did cause, to some extent, a contradiction for many women or a burden that they then rebelled against. I wonder if in that whole period there was any tension toward, at that time, socializing the family.
How do you mean socializing?
Well, it's toward when you're going to start making refrigerators, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can make big ones. You can make communal refrigerators or big
mm-hmm.
stoves, right? And then
mm-hmm.
everybody wouldn't do it privately, so that would lessen the burden to the woman,
mm-hmm.
the double burden to the
mm-hmm.
woman. But whether there was any push in the direction of doing that, of socializing that.
Well, some very smart people, like Charlotte Perkins Gilman, you know, recognized as early as 1903 that that would probably liberate women more, because it was really, it was the repetitiveness of many thousands of private households doing a task repetitively was wasteful of energy and didn't further, you know, the real human needs of anybody in that family. And she sort of suggested communal arrangements, and certainly socialists always spoke of that. I mean, you know, Marx and Engels spoke of moving in the direction of going back to community relations, but in a new progressive way, with all the advantages of modern industry and modern technology.